CITR Radio would like to remind you that this program is a three-dimensional color presentation. For quality sound and vivid imagery, please use your CITR 3D earplugs.
Hello, listeners. You are hearing CITR Docs Season 2. We are broadcasting from the ancestral and unceded territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. For a few weeks now, we've been releasing documentaries sourced from local producers as a part of CITR Docs Season 2. The theme of this year's documentaries is community, and we wanted that to be interpreted as broadly as possible. Right now, you're going to hear something very special. This is a radio documentary by producer Cal Murray. It dives into a subject in which everyone seems to be an expert and everyone seems to be a polemic. So I'm going to out myself briefly. Once upon a time, when I was playing way too many video games, still play way too many, but that's neither here nor there, and visiting 4chan pretty much every day, I remember being immersed in an engine for real kinds of hatred that would manifest in online harassment campaigns and doxing and trolling and etc. And how these actions were mobilized under a banner of pushing against an oppressive PC culture and defending the full right to think and say as you please. And people with the caveat that, oh, boys will be boys and this will all blow over soon. But of course, now it's incredibly popular to talk about how these cultures have been writ large on the world by recent international developments. Here at UBC, the Free Speech Club has itself been a lightning rod for controversy. Cal Murray happened by a rally against the Free Speech Club in the downtown East Side, and the story is the result of his choosing to take no easy answers. Stay tuned.
People showed up at Pigeon Park, where there was a new totem pole erected for the survivors of the missing Indigenous and murdered women.
It's December of 2016, and I'm in downtown Vancouver, speaking to a member of anti-fascist network Antifa.
And he felt comfortable to spout hateful shit about, you know, the Indigenous community.
He's wearing a balaclava, and he asks that I don't use his name. And I think the anonymity is because he feels for his safety. He is, after all, here to oppose the presence of Soldiers of Odin, a far-right anti-immigrant street gang. But Soldiers of Odin are only here as muscle, sort of unofficial security for the Christmas party of the Free Speech Club. The Free Speech Club is a group of mostly conservative or libertarian college students, who Antifa have identified as alt-right, but the Free Speech Club reject that label and say they're just fighting back against an oppressive campus culture of political correctness.
If you ever talk about Trump in a positive light, or any conservative view in a positive light on campus, People are gonna ostracize you. People will think you're some kind of a racist, misogynist, whatever label they have for you, and they want to keep you from talking, right? So it's kind of like a protest against that. It's a protest against the political correctness culture.
Neo-Nazis have this new manifestation in the alt-right, where they're just all clean-shaven college kids who just want to have a conversation. It doesn't make it any better.
Come drink and talk with us. Why are you standing out here?
Have a conversation.
Have a conversation.
Have a dialogue.
We're not actually white supremacists, you know.
Free speech is simply a moniker for them to say, I want to say shitty things and get away with it and normalize it.
So Antifa were pretty certain that what they were dealing with in the Free Speech Club was an alt-right group. And that's a perfectly justifiable conclusion, especially considering their allies on that particular night. But I wasn't really as satisfied with the alt-right moniker, given how liberally that term is tossed around in the wake of the Trump election. And so I felt I should dig a bit deeper to find out if the Free Speech Club really were alt-right and what alt-right even meant. To meet the people involved, to find the ideology that underpinned it, and to discover what made these people feel so isolated and alienated on campus. I'm Cal Wiseman-Murray, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, being broadcast from unceded Musqueam territory, and today I'm asking, what exactly is the alt-right? So I thought I should start with the person who had created all that chaos just from hosting a Christmas party. So I went looking for the Free Speech Club and I tracked down their founder.
One, I'm a person of color, Louis Jung. I'm bisexual, 23. And I grew up around poverty. I study visual arts in UBC Vancouver. Yes, I started the Free Speech Club, and it's one of the best things that I've ever done. It's amazing.
Well, the UBC Free Speech Club is, just as the name says, it's a club that focuses on the issues of free speech in Canada, especially in university campuses. We started this year, and we quickly became the most notorious and the most hated, most vilified group in UBC, and everyone loves to hate us. For example, a few days ago, we put up posters, and we have spies in the UBC feminism groups, and they were coordinating and organizing to take down the posters.
You've got spies though?
Yeah.
So we never used to decline people specifically for affiliation with the Free Speech Club, because that is silly, and being in that club does not necessarily make you anti-feminist. I'm Afi. I am a UBC student. I also admin and moderate the UBC Needs Feminism page, and I work within the local nonprofit feminism kind of environment. We ended up having some people who would screenshot our members' comments or posts and then post it to Free Speech Club, and essentially like berate and make fun of them, like personal attacks. Me, I don't particularly care if they're going to make fun of me behind my back. Like, it's vaguely annoying, but no more annoying than a mosquito. But I understand that it's really distressing to some of our members, and I guess making sure our members don't feel unsafe in the group is more important than letting in free speech members.
People who disagree with me and people who disagree with what my club stands for always calls me a troll. Always calls us a troll, and they think, oh, we're a big troll group on campus. And in a sense, they're kind of right. We are pretty trolly.
For some quick context on where the Free Speech Club actually sit politically, I will say that Lewis's fiancée, Theron Meyer, who is also involved with the club, has written for Breitbart, that Lewis himself is organising Q&A events with controversial U of T professor Jordan Peterson, and that the club made a point of wearing Make America Great Again hats on campus.
Trolling engages the layman. It awakens the people who are apolitical and dormant. If enough people get triggered and offended by it, and it starts to affect the people who have been dormant, and they start to think about it, you know what I mean? And people who get to engage the layman and who can get the layman on their side kind of wins the culture war.
Lewis was openly telling me that the Free Speech Club are fighting a culture war, that they see progressives and liberals as the dominant authoritarian force to be rebelled against. Personally, I find it hard to frame trolls as valiant underdog rebels when the rebellion amounts to little more than bullying or harassment, but it's complex and the balance of power online is always in flux. To get a better understanding of this culture war, I spoke with Angela Nagel, journalist and author of Kill All Normies, From 4chan to Donald Trump and the Alt-Right.
I think there's a mixture of people in there. I mean, I think there are genuinely some people who do feel that that speech is being stifled in universities and so on. There are others, of course, who are just opportunists and who will change their mind as soon as, you know, they find themselves in a position of power. I mean, historically, the right has been appalling on free speech issues.
Just a quick apology about the sound here. We had some difficulties recording via Skype, but we've done our best to make it listenable.
So, you know, I think that people who suspect that this is all, just an excuse for them to say whatever they want, I think they're right. There's two big problems. One is that the people who are defending free speech from that kind of right-wing position are not making any distinction between what you ought to be allowed to say, as in you shouldn't suffer sanctions from the state for saying, and then what you ought to say or you ought not to say on the grounds of all kinds of things, basic empathy, sort of manners, you know. one of the big fights that has gone on around the alt-right is sort of about the definition. So, you know, originally kind of everything was being called alt-right, from Trump all the way over to sort of neo-Nazis. And then, like, a group within that set were inclined to kind of say that they were the real alt-right, if you like, or the people who sort of came up with the name and therefore it sort of described them best. Well,
what Angela's saying is that it's a mistake to lump groups like the Free Speech Club in with the rest of the alt-right, and that we need to be a bit more careful with that distinction.
So I would consider that much broader group to be quite different. The ones that are primarily concerned with freedom of speech, you know, but also maybe would be critics of mass immigration, the kind of people I would associate with Milo Yiannopoulos, Gavin McInnes, and so on. I think that they are different. So I don't think that their central concern is necessarily race at all.
I felt like talking to Angela had helped me get to grips with the terminology. Alt-light seemed like a much better fit for the Free Speech Club than alt-right, because it removed the implication that Lewis, a Korean man, could even be a white supremacist. But I wondered if white supremacists would draw that same line, and how they felt about their more moderate allies or counterparts. I caught up with Tony McAleer, former neo-Nazi and organiser for the White Aryan Resistance, in his local pub.
At the age of 20, I thought I'd be dead or in jail by the age of 30 as a white revolutionary. I stockpiled assault weapons and ammunition and did paramilitary training in the woods. I joined the Canadian military to get training. I was on the Montel Williams show twice. In 1989, I was dressed like a skinhead. In 1991, I was wearing a suit and tie and had grown my hair out. It was in order to, you know, my gift was always to make the unreasonable sound reasonable, but you have to look reasonable as well. And it was purely to make the message more accessible to people. Towards the end of the 90s, and it's funny watching the alt-right emerge today and people like Richard Spencer, we said, don't get tattoos. That's how they can identify you. You know, put on a suit, dress better, go to college, grow your hair out, go mainstream.
I asked Tony why far-right groups like Sons of Odin would try to partner with or recruit from the Free Speech Club.
The darker, more extreme side of that movement will use and exploit anything it can possibly can. That's what I would have done. That's what I did do. But, you know, there's a full spectrum of beliefs. It's, you know, it's not just race. You get into the whole fiscal side of things and the Federal Reserve, and there's a whole spectrum of issues, and people have different ones that suit their fancy. And you know, even amongst Trump supporters, there's people that voted for Trump that can't stand Trump, but they voted because they wanted the Supreme Court seat. You want to be careful in boxing everyone into, you know, different labels, but those that can be used and exploited absolutely will be used and exploited. But to understand that, you know, anything past the center point is right, and you want to be careful that not to take everything right of center and throw it on to a, you know, a label, which, because those labels and the shaming of people entrenches them further. The violence and violence protests against them entrenches them further. And, you know, the scary thing that I see in the United States in the way things are moving now is there is no middle. The middle's evaporated. There's no compassion whatsoever. You've got two sides completely dehumanizing each other. The problem isn't the right. The problem isn't the left. The problem is dehumanization. And if the left wants to utilize the strategy of dehumanizing the right, you're going to empower the right. You're going to feed the right. There's nothing those trolls, and there's nothing I like more than having people come at me, be derogatory or threatened with violence. We fed off of that. So you want to be careful you're not feeding the beast that you're trying to destroy.
I was still cautious about the consequences of humanizing someone like Lewis, worried that it might normalize hateful and often disingenuous rhetoric. but Tony seemed to understand this world better than anyone I'd spoken to, so I decided to take his advice, and I sat down again with Lewis, this time intentionally leaving politics to one side.
Well, I was born in Korea, but I mostly grew up in the Philippines. I went to the Philippines when I was about 10 years old, and I left the Philippines when I was about 19 years old. So I grew up there. I went to elementary school, middle school, and high school there. My parents basically ran a small business in the Philippines and kept us going. It was pretty good, yeah. The reason why I speak English so well is because they ran an English academy, and I pretty much grew up in the business, and I pretty much learned English from my parents' employees. Oh, well, it's childhood memories, so it's kind of like glorified, right? So, you know, it was nice, warm, very dangerous. I remember it was very, very dangerous growing up there. I remember someone was killed outside of my house. His torso was cut in half and there was blood everywhere. The body was taken out before I was able to see it. It's a good thing I only saw the puddle of blood that was left over. One of the most dangerous avenues in the whole world is called Quezon Avenue, and it's called the Death Road because it has the highest rates of deaths. And there will be dead bodies on it maybe every month, sometimes weekly, sometimes monthly. But I was very lucky to avoid the brunt of it. I kind of became almost sedated to it. Like, to me, when I see physical violence, I wouldn't feel anything. And only when I came to Canada and I started therapy, like, I kind of broke apart and I became sensitive again. I was able to resensitize myself. And I grew a sense of empathy where if you had empathy while growing up in the Philippines, it takes a toll on you. And you kind of learn to block out that feeling. Physical violence, it was the modus operandi end. And I do not want to see that culture in Canada or in Korea, where problems are not solved through words, but through violence. I don't want to see that here.
So that was Lewis, and while it was hard to disagree with his concerns about violence, I couldn't quite square those concerns with his blasé attitude towards trolling and causing upset. Nonetheless, I'd grown to quite like Lewis. He's funny, he's engaging, and he can be genuinely warm and welcoming. And I wondered, perhaps patronisingly, if the young men of the alt-light and alt-right would eventually tire of trolling and move on to other pursuits, and hoped, maybe naively, that it was a passing fad, an inexplicable thing that we were obsessed with for a brief moment. As for Tony, I'll leave you with his story of how he left the neo-Nazi movement.
At 23, I found myself in the delivery room holding this beautiful little baby girl, and, you know, she has this little scrunchy face, and she opens her eyes, and I know that my face is the first picture that her brain's going to take. I'm now responsible for this other human being. You know, the beautiful thing about children is, in order to be in that state, in order to be that internet troll, in order to be in that place of that ideology that you're talking about, well, one generally has to be disconnected. I was completely disconnected from my heart. I was a bright, sensitive kid growing up in a household where it wasn't safe to be sensitive. I learned early on to shut my feelings down. And as I got into the skinhead thing and got into the violence, I was never a tough kid growing up. But my bullying survival strategy was befriend the bully, become the bully. You know, when I talk about violence, who one has to become in order to do violence is not something I would wish on anyone. I chose to go there, right? I don't ever blame anything on my childhood. Everything I did, I chose to do. But human beings don't do anything without a payoff. And what I got was acceptance, approval, attention. I got safety, a sense of power, notoriety. You know, the ability to instill fear in other people, to me, was a distorted sense of power. But it was intoxicating. The adrenaline rush was intoxicating. And I'll be honest, when I started doing it, I liked it.
Tony is now Executive Director of Life After Hate, a non-profit which helps individuals de-radicalise and leave extremist groups. For more information, visit lifeafterhate.org. This documentary was written and produced by me, Cal Wiseman-Murray, with production assistance from Billy Sampson and Jonathan Q. Thanks to Malone Mullen, thanks to Eleanor, John and everyone at CITR. For more on this series of short documentaries, visit citr.ca.
We just heard Everything's Alt Light by Cal Murray. It's the fifth episode of CITR Docs Season 2, so if you missed anything, be sure to subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, just look up CITR Docs, or keep checking out the citr.ca/docs page for updates. New docs come out Mondays and Wednesdays. And if you want to hear this documentary again, tune in Friday, 101.9 FM, CITR. We're going to be re-airing this documentary in tandem with a special interview with Cal. Thank you again to Cal for this wonderful piece, and thank you to CRFC Radio Meters for supporting this project with partial funding. Now, we're still not quite sure what you're going to be hearing on Wednesday as the next CITR doc, but here's a preview of something we have coming up. It's another one from Josh Gabbert-Doran, who co-produced the first documentary of this series. It's about rumors of a tunnel network under Chinatown in Vancouver and the racist implications that narrative may have.
Hey guys.
It's Saturday, around noon, and Malcolm Eric Hassan is tending bar at SBC. Malcolm is groggy. Last night there was a show at SBC. This morning there's people skating and coming in and out. About half the room is occupied by this wooden ramp that Malcolm and Andrew Turner, the other co-owner of the bar, built themselves. In its current form, it's a punk venue and a bar that sells cheap banana bread and greasy snacks. I've come to investigate a rumor that I heard a few months ago. The rumor says that there's a network of tunnels that runs underneath the neighborhood, and that the tunnel network connects with SBC. The rumor also says that the tunnels have been around for a long time, maybe 100 years or more. The rumor says that tunnels connect with SBC's basement, and that some dark, maybe even supernatural stuff has gone on down there over the course of their history. Here's Malcolm again. Word of warning. Parts of Malcolm's audio here is very, very bad quality, mainly because of the loud hair metal music in the back. It was a bar, after all.
Do you have any sense of where they went? Did they went towards the port, or they?
We've been told to go as far as Stanley Park, like that they're all connected.